There was a personality by the name of Saul who was a zealot. He was also a person who constantly attracted attention to himself. He became known as Paul. He knew a lot about the Pharisees because he had studied at the feet of Gamaliel. So he knew what they were like, and he was zealous. He was constantly in the ring, always doing something. There was no, as we say, idle bone in his body. And the more he spoke, the more he got into trouble. And he went from place to place, and finally God called him, along with Barnabas, for a certain task. And, of course, remarkably, he even had difficulty with Barnabas. This was a part of his personality. But he went around from one place to another in Grecian Asia Minor. And then he went into the European area proper, in the region of Greece. He had also been in the Mediterranean Isles, and then he was going to go to Rome. So he went from one area to another. He labored more abundantly than all of them. And God said, there is time now not to travel, not to journey, Paul. There is a time to go to prison. And to take it easy, if that's what he could do, and to sit down and to write some things and to care for the churches, because you're going from place to place to place to place. And you need some time to rethink what needs to be done for the care of the churches. And Paul later mentions even what a burden and a responsibility that was. So it's interesting to see how God uses individuals at different times in history. There was a time for Paul to be in prison and a time to be released, after which, if we use the Spanish tradition, he went briefly through Spain for 2 years and then arrived in Britain in AD 64. His release, or let's go back and say that he got into trouble in Jerusalem in 56, and then he was in prison between 56 and 62. He was, of course, 2 years imprisoned in the region that we would call Greater Syria, 56 to 58. And then, of course, that shipwreck that led him to be a prisoner without a prison. And he got to Italy in 59. I should say, this is incorrect. I should start in 57. Please correct your note, not 56. In 57, he came to the area of Jerusalem. In 59, he then was released from the prison to go on board ship. And then it was 60 that he finally got to Rome as a result of that winter in without a prison. You remember when the ship was wrecked. And he was 2 years in prison. The Jews no longer brought accusation. So that brings us to 62. In 62 to 64, he went through Spain, and by 64, he arrived in Britain. How long he stayed there, we do not know, but the implication is he was clearly back in 67 in Asia Minor, at which point he was seized, and then he was executed by Nero upon the return of Nero out of Greece into Italy in AD 68. And within days after the execution of Paul, Nero committed suicide. So God had a reason why Paul should journey, why Paul should be in prison, why Paul should not have gotten to Britain earlier, why he should therefore be released. We might wonder why some of these things occur, but God has his reasons. And you can analyze some of them in terms of what the limitations can be when it occurs that way. Now, as we look at the story, the church was born in the region of Judea, Jerusalem in particular, and there was ultimately a time to flee the area. So the church migrates. And what we have for many centuries is a time in which the church dwells in the Roman Empire and then formally has to flee to the border confines of the realm, as a result, fundamentally, of the Council of Nicaea in 325, when the pagan Pontifex Maximus, or chief priest, Constantine, not yet a Christian, called the Christians together and told them to settle all their differences, and in so doing, he also told them that anybody who doesn't agree has to get out. We're going to have one universal Church of God, the Catholic Church of God, and that's that, and the rest must leave, and the Church had to learn to flee. And so the Church fled ultimately out of the region of Asia Minor, where the largest group was settled, into the Western Asia Minor, into the east central area of Armenia, and from there, centuries later, they learned to leave and to migrate somewhere else in the Balkans through to the Alpine region. They had to learn that they could live in the Alpine region for a while, and then there is a time again to move, and they moved to Britain. And then God brought to the attention of the Church in the middle of the 17th century that there was a time to come to the New World, because colonies were being established in the New World in the British or English-speaking areas. I happily had the privilege for the first time only months ago. This was an archaeological convention in Boston, and I took the privilege the day before the primary sessions to have the opportunity to visit Rhode Island and to visit Newport and the other communities, to see the graves of the early Sabbath-keeping ministers and the buildings in which the membership Christians who were called Sabbatarians met. This is the group that gradually came to represent the focus of the Church in the New World, and it was indeed a remarkable experience. But many of these people learned later there was a time not to stay in Rhode Island, but a time to move, and they moved into West Virginia and other areas across the country. We know the bulk of those people as Seventh-day Baptists to this day. That is what they became by 1802. Then in 1831, we had quite a different situation. If we go back to the 1600s and the late 1500s, we could say it was the time to announce the Sabbath to a world that as a whole had forgotten it. But in 1831, there was a time to announce the Second Advent. They used the word Advent from Second Coming. So we'll use the term that was then extant, the time to announce the return of Christ, that he was going to come back and he was going to judge the world. William Miller was the man who was used to announce that beginning in 1831. Now what was remarkable, of course, is that the churches of Christ, sometimes called the churches of God, mostly the churches of Christ, who were Sabbatarians, who had come over in the middle of the 17th century, were now essentially no longer doing the work of God. And God had to call somebody who had no immediate background with those people, who was William Miller. And he called many out of the denominations that were extant then in New England and elsewhere. It was 18 centuries after the crucifixion, AD 31. So it was a time to announce the Second Advent. And then it was a time for those people to learn about the Sabbath, which they did in 1846. And then it was a time to examine whether there were visions of God or visions that were not of God that were coming to a woman, Ellen G. White. And it was a time for some, the majority, to stay with those who followed the visions, and a time for the minority to leave. And that minority came to be the background of the Church of God, Seventh Day. There came a time in the 20th century that God sent an advertising man to come among them, whose name was Herbert Armstrong. And he came with ideas that he had never learned in the Church. He learned this in the advertising field, and he brought it to the Church. And people began to listen to him in the Oregon Conference area, the Willamette Valley. There was a time to ordain him. There was a time when he was asked to write for the Bible Advocate, and a time when he was not. There was a time when, we might say, of the Churches of God in the 1930s, a time to open the doors that no man can shut, and a time to shut the doors that no man could open. And they're both there, and we haven't seen them both. And so for those who chose not to continue to be the live branches of the Churches of God The door was shut. And after now more than 100 years of publishing the Bible Advocate, they only have thousands on their mailing list. But for the Oregon Conference, the time had come of the Church of God to open the doors that no man could shut. And of that conference, there were one half who were wise and one half who were foolish. Don't assume that the wise and the foolish virgins occurs only at one time in history. If you've ever read Mr. Armstrong's co-worker letters, you know he applied them in more than one way. That was a time when five were wise and five were foolish. And five stayed with those whose doors were shut. And five stayed with the congregation and supported the congregations around Eugene and elsewhere that Mr. Armstrong was used to found. And to them the door was opened. And the work began to spread. And for 12 years Mr. Armstrong raised up churches and they disappeared. Raised up Bible studies and they disappeared. And some congregations, of course, that he could directly minister to didn't disappear. And that told him something very important. It was a time to move and to establish a college, to train the ministry, because he found that if whenever he was there, the congregation remained solid and firm. And whenever he was gone and turned the responsibility over to someone whom he had not trained, and remember, unlike the Jews who were trained in the synagogue for generations, many of these people had no real background in the Church of God for generations. And they let the flock disappear. And so in 1946, Mr. Armstrong came to Southern California to examine, and by that time, of course, I had heard the program in 1944, so all that I have told you is history. The rest is now, in part, experience. I read the first co-worker letter Mr. Armstrong issued in 1946, in which he said there are two pieces of property. One is nearby, and the other is a place that I have never found. He never described it further. Yes, there was a time to make choice, and he made choice of something here in the area of Orange Grove to establish a college and to move the headquarters. There were those who said he should not move. There were those who said, fine, let's do it. There were those who said, we don't need a college. We don't need nothing like that. The doors are shut, and some of those people, of course, long since have disappeared from memory. So the college was founded in 1947, and the doors were opened. Now, it's remarkable what has happened, of course. After 1950-51, one can say that, in a certain sense, Ambassador College was the focus of the work, in this sense that the bulk of the effort that was being carried out was not expressed through publishing. It was, of course, heard often in repeat broadcasts on radio, but it was, in fact, the effort of the students who had been trained by Mr. Armstrong and whom he delegated responsibility to during the summer and the baptizing tours and finally to administer Bible studies in local congregations. And Mr. Armstrong was the fundamental teacher. So very often, in a sense, the college was seen as the focal point. And many, many people contributed money to the college, whether or not they were members, because they saw that the college was accomplishing something. This was a very remarkably creative move, to have a college for the training of young men and women. Perhaps, in my judgment, Mr. Armstrong's greatest single contribution intellectually and in terms of foresight that has been made. Without the college, this church would not be where it is. It's not the reverse. It's not the reverse. Many people contributed who were not members in those days. In passage of time, we come to a realization that when a man is in his 90s, in a sense, there is a time to live and a time to die. And so, essentially, 4 years and 10 days ago on the Roman calendar, Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong passed from the scene. A time for the administration of the work of the Church of God to to take new focus. Mr. Armstrong's primary work was to construct. And you will pardon the parallel, but now there is the time for perestroika, to reconstruct. That is, when things are 40, 30, or 20 years old, and remember the college was opened 43 years ago, you would be surprised that the minority of people who are in this room were born after the college was opened. The majority were born after, the minority were born before. Half of the people in this country are under 30 years of age. Half of the people in Peru are under 15. That's just because of the population variation. But nevertheless, we have to realize after 40 or 30 or 20 years, and some of our main buildings are now 20 years old, we have to reconsider. This is what Mr. Tkach has called the infrastructure. We have to reconsider now our priorities. So there was a time to construct, a time to build, and now we have a time, in a sense, to reconstruct the campus in Big Sandy, to reconstruct what it is we should be doing here in Southern California. Yes, there was a time to stay in Eugene and a time to move from Eugene, a time to move to Pasadena, and a time for part of the work to move from Pasadena. We have to be realistic. If you would say we shouldn't ever do anything like this, we would still be in Jerusalem. If you want to argue about Jerusalem, you should say we still ought to be at Kadesh Barnea. You see, there is a time to change. Now we have to know what to move and when to move and why to move. Solomon only told you that there was a time. He did not say how you were to judge. But he did say you ought to be wise and have insight and not to put all your efforts in one basket. You never, of course, want to carry, as they say, for those who are chicken farmers, don't carry all your eggs in one bucket. If you stumble, they can be broken. The principle is clear. There was, in fact, in the last 40 years, a time to enter the gun lap and a time not to enter the gun lap. I want to address this question. You see, Mr. Armstrong often thought in terms of his own lifespan. And the shorter his life got, very often he thought that it was indeed a gun lap. And you know what he said was a gun lap? Was a gun lap for Herbert W. Armstrong. But he told the church, and he wanted the church's support. When you hear Mr. Armstrong writing, thinking that we must do this, we must do that, we must be zealous, we must open the doors here and there, we must walk through, Mr. Armstrong was talking to himself. He had to know how to push himself. He was a man who needed a prod. Not everybody needs a prod. Just because you must put a prod on yourself, says the Seven Laws of Success, it doesn't mean that every man has to reach out for a prod and prod himself. Some people are self-starters. Mr. Armstrong was not. He had to prod himself. I remember before we ever left Belknap Springs in Oregon at the Feast of Tabernacles, Mr. Armstrong said, "We're in the gun lap." Because for him, if he weren't in it, he wouldn't be running as fast as he needed to. That was a part of his nature. Mr. Tkach doesn't need that kind of prod. I know him. He doesn't have to say it of himself. He is not asking himself to run in the gun lap. Now is the time to restructure, because there is work ahead, and we have to now structure what we are doing in terms of seeing the nature of the work ahead. This is now a time in economic stress when we don't ask the brethren to give their last monies. This is a time also to restructure the brethren's lives so they will be prepared both economically and spiritually and morally to run the course of the decade we are entering, the 1990s. And if we do analyze ourselves spiritually, as the co-worker letters, I received mine today, perhaps you did as well. If you do what you need to do spiritually. You do what you need to do morally, and we'll focus on that in addition because it's all part of the spiritual. And carefully analyze what you need to do economically. We will be prepared then to take the creative steps that inevitably will come our way when areas of the world now in chaos in Eastern Europe become restructured in such a way that we can effectively enter the area and do the work that needs to be done. There is a time to be a superpower and a time not to be a superpower. We did not know how it would happen, but now we have the picture before us. Two superpowers arose after World War II. One, an economic and military superpower. Another, a military superpower whose weakness had always been the economic. That was, as we saw, and there was, as we saw, an Achilles' heel. The question is, what arrow would strike the Achilles' heel of the Soviet Union that would bring this military superpower down economically? And it turned out to be their own judgment, their own covetousness, in the form of the occupation of Afghanistan that for 10 years drained them and morally ruined the country and has introduced drugs and prostitution and every other evil that 25 years ago was not in the Soviet Union anywhere near the extent that we see these today. There is a time for the United States to be a superpower and a time for us not to be an economic superpower. Notice my change of phrase. We are still a military superpower, so is the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union is now simply a third world country. We are not a third world country, but we are no longer an economic superpower. In fact, we have two nations that are economic superpowers, but neither of them are military superpowers. One is Japan and one is the Federal Republic of Germany. Today we are in quite an unusual world in which we have become the greatest debtor nation in the history of the world. Mr. Descartes is thinking realistically not to overextend ourselves, to know what to do with monies at the time while we are still the greatest debtor nation and living on other people's money before the rug is pulled out from under us because of our own mistakes and not others' wickedness. The Soviet Union made their own mistakes. We are going to make our own as a nation. Because we are not coming to grips with what our friends or critics are telling us correctly. We want the Japanese to change. We are not willing to listen to the Japanese telling us what we need to do to help us change. That is not at least at the highest levels of government, though some private businesses are. This decade is a decade in which the United States is going to realize it is no longer an economic superpower, and sooner or later, probably later in this decade, we're going to realize what happens. And what you have seen in Eastern Europe in terms of the collapse of the economic capacity of the Soviet Union to support its military power, we're going to see the effects of that great debt that we have built up in the late 1980s, and it is going to so transform the economic status of this country that we have to be prepared for the consequences in the work. Australia is a very small regional superpower in Australasia, and Australia is in a terrible shape, just as this country is economically. But we do have men who are trying to steer the country through the economic shoals, and the chance of maneuvering is getting more and more limited. These men in charge of the economic aspects of our lands and of Canada and of Britain And the great nations speaking English are in the most difficult position outside of third world and second world countries. The Soviet Union is traditionally the second world. You've heard of the third world. Communist countries were the second world, that is of the Soviet Union. But there is no second world there. It's vanished. Vanished. It's a third world country. And we are headed for an economic third world condition in terms of our standard of living, as distinct from our infrastructure, because we are a technically advanced industrial country. But this country clearly is headed for, but not this year or necessarily the next or the next. We are headed for a third world economic standard of living. You cannot avoid it when we are the greatest debtor nation in the world. It cannot be avoided. But it will not happen. There is a time for that. And the time has not come because we have not done all that is necessary to get our house yet economically in order. And God looks at the big picture. And He is able to postpone, able to have men make decisions that keep the inevitable from happening. No, the debt collapse has not yet occurred. No, it isn't going to happen immediately. But there will come an avalanche. You're not surprised, are you? You've seen an avalanche in 1989. Eastern Europe collapsed like a bank. You know, along the coast here, the mud banks, finally it's so soaked with water that it just slides down. The Soviet Union was soaked with propaganda and debt and a decay in morality that they couldn't support what was behind the Iron Curtain west of the Soviet Union and now even inside. That same thing is going to happen to this country. There is no way to forestall it, but it isn't going to happen immediately. I would suspect it's going to happen in the last half of this present decade. I won't predict any more. You have your part in this work to watch how God reveals Himself to the leadership and through circumstances to know when it is the time to do what the church is asked to do and not to make the mistake and say, it isn't time. I want nothing to do with it. Those who decided not to enter the promised land are never part of those to whom the promises pertain.